D-Mace, Finnegan, and Donick, 102.5, 106.3, the game. Broadcasting from the Busy Bee Plumbing, Heating, and Air Conditioning Game Nashville Studios, home of the $99 yearly Beehive membership, where the buzz is always about great service, and we are presented by Bet365. Whatever the moment, it's never ordinary at Bet365. Willie Donick, Adam Vingan here with you. Chasing Big Joe, live in Atlanta for SEC Media Days. Their coverage starts at noon, and it is sponsored by Brewhouse South. Experience Nashville's ultimate sports and brew hangout at Brewhouse South in Cool Springs. We may be joined by Chase McCabe in the final segment of our show. We can get the nice little check-in from Atlanta at SEC Media Days. So, Willie, before the break, I said there is a word that general managers are hesitant to use. They may consider it a potty word, which is a new saying my three-year-old son uses. I also freaked out David James when I was going to talk about this word. It is not an actual obscenity, so don't worry. But that potty word, quote-unquote, is rebuild. And it's a popular topic of conversation across all sports when things aren't going well. And if you haven't noticed, things aren't really going well around here for our two major professional sports teams, the Tennessee Titans and the Nashville Predators.
And the word, just to finish your thought or add to your thought,
yes,
about the potty word, we saw a great example the last couple years. The Titans will not use that word.
They will not use that
word. They will not use that word. They steadfastly, when asked about it, is this a rebuild? No. It's not a rebuild.
Again,
we're not rebuilding. They will not use it because it's a potty word. It's seen as a very a white flag waving kind of thing.
The thought of Titans brass using the word rebuild makes them throw up in their mouth a little bit. Like, we're not rebuilding. Like, they can't even get the word out because it makes
them. And the Predators as well, right? Barry Trotz has been asked a lot. He's more philosophical about it.
Mm-hmm.
But he and Andrew Burnett have said, no, this is not what we're doing. We don't want to do that.
So last week, I stumbled across an article at dailyfaceoff.com written by Paul Peduti, with the headline, "Do Rebuilds Actually Work in the NHL?" It is a fascinating read. And Peduti's goal was to answer these key questions. How long does a rebuild usually take? Does it actually work? And why are teams rebuilding so slowly today? Now, Willie, you and I have had some animated discussions over the years about the plan. That's a trigger word for Willie Donick when it comes to the Predators sometimes.
Right.
We've had some animated conversations about the Predators' plan, and I thought that Peduti did a really good job of laying out just how successful rebuilds can be. So let's start here. Here is how Peduti set the parameters for what he considers a rebuild. A rebuild starts when a team has at least two bottom 10 finishes, including a bottom 8 finish in a 3-year period. So according to Peduti, that's when a rebuild starts. So even if you have a good season within that stretch, it doesn't count as you exiting the rebuild.
Right.
According to him, you exit the rebuild when you make the playoffs in consecutive years or win the Stanley Cup in your return to the postseason. So those are his parameters. You can argue with those parameters, but we will use those parameters for the purpose of this exercise. And here's what I thought was interesting. He put together a chart of NHL rebuild timelines of the salary cap era, so since the 2005-2006 season. According to his guidelines, in the salary cap era, so the past 20 years, there have only been three NHL teams that have not undergone a rebuild. The Dallas Stars, the Vegas Golden Knights, and keep in mind the Golden Knights have been around for less than a decade, and your Nashville Predators, according to Peduti, are the only three teams, based on his criteria, that have not undergone a rebuild over the past 20 years.
So really two, when you get down to it.
Let's call it two and a half.
Because Vegas is such a unique situation. So yeah, two and a half is a good term.
Let's call it two and a half. But there is this really cool color-coded chart and all of that. But I do want to get to the crux of this article. So according to Peduti, there are 13 franchises that are at least 4 years into a rebuild right now. So nearly half the league.
Mm-hmm.
Now, based on his guidelines, the Predators would enter a rebuild if they once again finish in the bottom 10 of the NHL standings this coming season. So, Willie, when we have these discussions, you often note there is no guarantee that a rebuild will work. Look at the Buffalo Sabres. Look at the Detroit Red Wings. They've been rebuilding for eons. It feels that way, at least. Mm-hmm. And they have gotten no closer to competing. So what Peduti did, which is easy for me to say, what Peduti did was he looked at the 20 rebuilds completed in the last 20 years, some of which extend past the salary cap era, so before 2005-2006. He looked at the past 20 rebuilds to see how long, on average, those rebuilds take. His findings were the average rebuild takes 8.5 years.
8.5 years.
8.5 years.
How old will your son Arlo be
in 8.5 years?
8.5 years.
Well, he turns 4 next month.
Turns 4.
So he'll be 12? 12-ish? 12, 13?
He'll be in middle school.
He'll be in middle school.
Oh, boy.
That's a big jump. That's a long time. 8.5 years.
He notes in the article.
That's the average.
The average of the 20 completed rebuilds of the last 20 years. The average length is 8.5 years.
And remember, that's just not making the playoffs in consecutive years.
Yes.
You could even make the playoffs in one of those years and still be in the rebuild. It still takes you 8.5 years.
So, for example, to your point, Willie, for example, the Colorado Avalanche were rebuilding between 2009 and 2019. They had a third place finish in 2014.
Right.
But that was
a little bit of an anomaly. Yeah.
Precisely. So just because they finished third in the league that 1 year doesn't mean they were out of the rebuild.
So they did have at least a couple of flickers of interesting hockey, but I think we would call them a team that had a successful rebuild, right?
Because they won the Stanley Cup.
They won the Stanley Cup, and they've been a top 7 or 8 team in the overall standings for now 6 straight years. So they're in the window now.
Mm-hmm.
And so what they did to get that, they went through 11 years of technically. And now you can say that
11 seasons.
They were coming out of it. Remember when they lost to the Predators
mm-hmm.
in the first round, when the Predators won the Stanley Cup in 2017-18, they snuck in there, made the playoffs, and made it again in 2019. So I think you can say they were coming out of it after 8 years, but basically they had 8 really rough years. 8 years of building to get what they have now. Now, because it was successful, because it's so far in the rear view, their fans would say, yeah, that worked. But when you're in those 8 years, I can remember traveling to some games out there where the crowds weren't real good. They didn't have much to lean on. Remember the Patrick Waugh? That was a real volatile time that they had. You got to go through some rough, rough times. The question is, to me, when we look at these, is really when you see the 8.5 years, is it worth it? Is that what you have to do?
We will get to that.
And are there better pathways, the pathways that the Stars and the Predators are trying to do? Stars have been successful with it, I think. The Predators are trying to be successful with it. Is that the better way to go about it? Or do you just have to resign yourself to saying, if you're going to go into the rebuild, prepare for 8 to 10 years of being bad?
So let's use the Tampa Bay Lightning as an example. As Peduti writes, quote, the Lightning fell near the bottom of the NHL in 2008, stayed there for most of 6 years, drafted future Hall of Famer Steven Stamkos, Victor Hedman, Nikita Kucherov, and Andrei Vasilevsky, and by 2015 were prepared to be a perennial threat. 4 Stanley Cup finals and 2 rings later, John Cooper is still squeezing playoff spots from that rebuild today, just like they drew it up.
Yeah, and the last, you have to say that that was an extremely successful rebuild, and it was relatively short. Tampa.
By the way, the Panthers topped the list for futility. According to Peduti's criteria, the Panthers were rebuilding for 20 years. Yeah. 20 years.
If you go back before the salary cap.
Yes.
And the
from 2001 through 2021, they were rebuilding. Yeah. But you know what? Now they've won back-to-back Stanley Cups and have been to three consecutive Stanley Cup finals.
Right. So I don't know that you could even say that they were rebuilding.
That is the extreme end of the scale. But again, yes, the average
they were
length.
Just not a good franchise for a good part of that. Tampa, I think you could say, you know, because they had gone to the Stanley Cup final and won it in 2004.
Yes.
Then sort of had the remnants of that for a couple of years, then dipped back down. They were successful in that they dropped really low, very quick, and then hit it big with the high picks that they had, and it happened relatively quick that they got back. Like, that would be the ideal rebuild, right? Because not only have they won multiple Stanley Cups and had a great franchise for a long, long time, and they're still a good team. They're not as good as they were a few years ago, but they still go into a season thinking, you got a chance. That would be the model that you could follow. But very few teams have been able to hit it like that, right? Feast to famine, go down quick, and then come back up even quicker.
The fastest possible rebuild under Peduti's definition was executed by the Carolina Hurricanes. They rebuilt in the minimum 3 years. After losing the 2002 Stanley Cup final, the Canes crumbled to finish 30th, which was last place at the time, 22nd, and then won the 2006 Stanley Cup with Peter Laviolette.
And that was interesting because it was the first
year of the
salary
cap era. It can be done, but tossing the sample's outliers, we're looking at 5 to 12 years with 8 or 9 years as the norm, as the average for a rebuild.
But Carolina, it should be noted, dipped back down quickly. Peter Laviolette was fired. I know you're surprised to hear that. He does his thing, and then he moves on.
Then they rebuilt from 2010. They rebuilt from 2010 through 2020, if I'm reading this chart right.
See, the thing about this chart is that you could have two really good teams, but you're not out of the rebuild technically until you do it for a third straight year. I don't know if I would say that that's...
You can argue with the criteria.
They got good in 2019. They got really good. Mm-hmm. But still, that's 8 straight years. Here are the finishes for one of the most successful, consistent franchises going right now, the Hurricanes. They are consistent. They haven't won it all. But a lot of people would take their track record the last, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. They've been a top 10 team for 7 straight years now.
They win at least a playoff round. Every year.
But it took them... This run, 2010, they finished 24th, 19th, 23rd, 25th, 24th, 26th, 18th, 20th, 21st. 8 straight years of being an also-ran.
And to your point...
Not even sneaking into the playoffs.
And to your point about them being one of the most consistent teams in the NHL, they have yet to get over the hump.
They haven't won the whole thing.
Correct. They've made it to the conference final on multiple occasions, but have not been able to break through to the Stanley Cup final.
I have a hard time saying you have to win the cup for it to be a, quote, successful rebuild. To me, what Carolina has done, when you give yourself a chance for that many years in a row where you have a legit shot, that's all you can do. And you just have to hope that your players break through and have that one great year where everything goes right.
Let's go to Luke on our phone line, driven by Wilson County, Hyundai.com. Luke, thank you for calling. Please go ahead.
Hey, Willie, do you think that it's a situation when you're rebuilding like this to pick, you know, Vincent LeCavalier instead of David Laguan or somebody like that situation? Like, is it the right player more than it is the coach? Because I feel like you can carousel tons of coaches into catching a guy like that's outrageously more talented than the next guy.
Thank you for the call, Luke.
I think that is a little bit of the luck of the draw is when you do this, who happen to be the top picks at the top of a draft. Because you're not going to pick first every year. Like he mentioned, Vincent LeCavalier and David Laguan, those were the first two guys picked in the first draft the Predators were ever in. And there was a pretty big gap. I mean, Legwon was certainly not a bust. You know, he played in the league as a good player for a long time, but Le Cavalier was a pretty good franchise player, right? He was a bigger hit. So when you're in a rebuild, you're picking, let's just say, what, in the top 5 to 7 a lot of times? Sometimes what was Victor Hedman? 5th, something like that? Kucherov? These guys that end up being picked 5th, 6th, and you get a franchise all-star.
Hedman was the 2nd overall pick in 2009. Kucherov was a 2nd-round pick in 2011.
Kucherov was a 2nd-rounder?
Yes, 58th overall.
Okay.
Steven Stamkos, of course, was the 1st overall pick in the draft. Andrei Vasilevskiy was the 19th pick in the 2012 draft.
So I do think sometimes drafts are deeper than others, as we noted a lot of times. Supposedly, only time will tell, this was not a good year to have the 5th pick. The Predators had to make do with that, right? They're hoping they get a special player in Brady Martin, but it doesn't look like it's a slam dunk, as much of a slam dunk as it does some years where the draft is supposedly deeper.
615-737-1025. Our phone and text lines are driven by WilsonCountyHyundai.com. Do rebuilds actually work in the NHL? As Paul Baduti writes for Daily Faceoff, the average length of the 20 rebuilds completed in the salary cap era is 8.5 years, as Willie emphasized. How successful have they been? The results may surprise you. I will share that coming up next. 615-737-1025. Willie Donick, Adam Vingan, 1025, 1063, the game. D. Mace, Vingan, and Donick, 1025, 1063, the game. Willie Donick, Adam Vingan here with you. I didn't mention this earlier in the show, but according to John Rothstein, Memphis's Nolan Smith, I should note, national champion with Duke, is finalizing a deal to be the next head coach at TSU. Nothing is officially done, but the two sides are working towards an agreement. So.
Okay. So maybe Adam will be watching a little more TSU Tiger basketball.
Well, if Nolan Smith's tenure at TSU goes as well as Nate James's did at Austin Peay, I'm not sure I'll be watching a lot of it because I don't feel like Nate James lasted a long time at Austin Peay.
Okay.
But we shall see. So we are talking about NHL rebuilds and do they actually work? A story by Paul Peduti on dailyfaceoff.com. So here is the gist of it. According to his criteria, the average length of a rebuild, of a successful rebuild in the salary cap era, takes 8.5 years. 8.5 years. Keep that number in mind. That's a long time. As you noted, Willie, my son will be 12 or 13 years old by then. But here's the question. How successful have those rebuilds been? So taking those 20 rebuilt franchises, here is what Paul Baduti found. Quote, the 20 most recent rebuilds were extremely successful. The teams that set themselves up to peak at various points between 2006 and 2025 have mostly done exactly that. Half of the 20 rebuilds resulted in at least one Stanley Cup, generating 17 of the 20 titles in the cap era. Only the 2007 Ducks, 2008 Red Wings, and 2023 Golden Knights were not products of traditional rebuilds that ended in the cap era. Every rebuild can't end with a cup, though. There is only one to go around. But even those franchises, sans Stanley, have had legitimate success from rebuilding, whether cup finals appearances, Edmonton, multiple conference final berths, Islanders, lengthy postseason streaks, Toronto, or a President's Trophy, Rangers, all but two of the rebuilds created competitive teams. While it's cup or bust in public, there are many owners and GMs that would love to make a conference final or build a postseason lock to roll the dice with annually. Our rebuild criteria create a self-fulfilling prophecy. If a franchise can finish near the bottom of the league a couple of times and build a roster good enough to get in the playoffs in consecutive seasons, success over the next decade is extremely likely.
Yes. So basically what you're saying is if you put in the time, the 8 years or whatever, you usually do see some fruits.
Yes.
It remains to be seen for a team like Ottawa. And Buffalo would be another one that's still looking for the end of the rainbow here. One thing that's interesting to me about this era, Because there's a difference between 2006 through 2013 if you're rebuilding as opposed to now. And it's this. Now, at least the trend has been, you rebuild, you get the high picks, you often, and I think this has been the case with Buffalo, it's definitely been the case with Ottawa. I think we look closer, there's other examples where you have to invest in the players big money before the team wins. Ottawa would be the best example. They've got their team laid out. There's not a whole lot of room for them to add veteran pieces to the young nucleus that they've taken so long to build. Ottawa finally made the playoffs, so they're technically still in the rebuild according to this criteria. Let's say they're out of it.
The Senators would need to make the playoffs again this coming season to be out of the rebuild according to Peduti's criteria.
Okay, so Ottawa finished to get to where they are now. 30th, 31st, 30th, 23rd, 26th, 21st, 26th, and then last year they finally got in there. So seven straight years of being bad and picking high. But what's happened in there is they've had to make some decisions on players while they have not seen success. Tim Stützle would be one of the featured guys. He's a really good player. They're paying him handsomely. He's still young, but they're locked into him. The expectation is for him to be a star. He hasn't won anything yet. And so there's a lot of guys on their roster that it looks like it's going to happen. But they've already had to commit. And in doing so, they haven't left themselves a lot of room to find that Ryan O'Reilly or that extra guy, that crafty veteran that costs you a certain amount but puts you over the top. That's the hard part about this is you got to make decisions on guys even before you see the fruits of your rebuild. With the contracts that are out there.
So the Predators, according to the criteria laid out by Paul Peduti, are one of, we'll call it two and a half teams that have not rebuilt in the salary cap era. The others, the Dallas Stars and the Vegas Golden Knights, they're the half since they've been around for the past, what, 8-9 years. But the Predators would enter a rebuild after this season. If they finish once again in the bottom 10. So here's the question. Here's the million-dollar question. Based on the findings of this research, rebuilds are highly successful. Would it be in the Predators' best interest to have another bottom 10 finish this season, to enter a rebuild, to have another opportunity to draft high, knowing that, again, according to this data, it is more likely than not that it will lead to success in the long run?
I think the Predators situation is unique because we're putting all of the rebuilds into one category here, but there's when you look at team by team, there's a lot of different ways that they got there. We just talked about Ottawa finishing very low for a long time. The Predators, just by finishing low 2 years in a row, that would only be two high picks. I think there's a chance. We've talked about this. They have the ability this year, especially with their roster flexibility, the Duchesne buyout coming off of the books next year, to really go in an aggressive direction after this coming year, if they want to. And they've also stocked their farm system already with a lot of good prospects. Now, they don't have that high pick that is a franchise-changing guy, which everybody loves to covet. San Jose is really going all in for that. They've gone now six straight years of being pretty bad. The last 2 years, they finished dead last. And they're getting lauded for handling it pretty well. They like what they're doing. But the fact is, it's going to take at least a few more years before they're in position to win anything significant.
And the Sharks, right? The Sharks had their run. They were one of the best teams in the league for several years, went to the Stanley Cup final the year before the Predators went to the Stanley Cup final. Both teams lost to the Penguins. But to your point about the young players in the system, friend of the show, Scott Wheeler, yesterday published his list of the top 100 drafted NHL prospects. The Predators have six players in this top 10 list. I believe tied for second most, according to Wheeler. Here's the issue. The highest rated player, for the Predators on this list is Brady Martin, whom they just selected with the fifth overall pick. He comes in at number 22. He's in tier three. Now, it doesn't say what tier three means, but he is in tier three. The next closest player is Tanner Molendijk at 40, Cameron Reed at 61. They are both in tier four. In tier five, Ryker Lee at 74, Matthew Wood at 90, and Zachary LaRue at 95.
Right, and the Predators would have their own evaluation of all their guys. I think what they have is a wide volume of players that they think can be good, winning NHL players. They're not all going to make it. And I don't know if any one of them is going to be the game-breaking superstar. That would be really nice. But if you get a pool of good players coming up through the system together that are cheap for a while, that gives you the ability to build a roster. So this is where we've gotten into a lot of pick your lane. I don't. What they're trying to do is, if it goes south this year, which it very well could, you're not going to hear a lot of people go into the season saying, hey, the Predators, they're going to be awesome. You're not going to hear that. It'll be a much more skepticism. And if it goes that way, they can pivot and pick high again. And who knows? Long term, that might be the best thing for the long term. You have a second straight year. But they're going to be much in a much better position to come back up the charts faster, I think, because they haven't mortgaged their future. They already have a good farm system, and they would have another high pick to go with it. And we just mentioned a lot more salary cap room. But they're giving themselves a chance to where if things fall right this year, maybe they come back and get into the playoffs again. If Soros, Josi, Forsberg rebound and have great seasons, the free agents they signed last summer are better this year. There, you can talk yourself into and see a plausible scenario where they're a good team next year.
What that list from Wheeler says to me, and we've discussed this, that the Predators prospect pool is deep, but it's missing that...
the crown jewel.
Correct. And the Predators hope Brady Martin can be that player. I wonder if it would be in their best interest to have another high pick that they can team with Brady Martin, similar to what you're seeing. You mentioned San Jose, and we don't know if that's going to work out, right? But they've got Macklin Celebrini. They have Will Smith. They have Michael Misa. You hope that that is the next core, the next version of Joe Pavelski and Logan Couture and Joe Thornton, right? Mm-hmm. Patrick Marleau. You're hoping for that. So the Predators have plenty of solid prospects, to use your term. They're missing that crown jewel. Yeah. But you look at some of these other teams that have undergone these rebuilds, right? McDavid and Draisaitl. Barkov and Ekblad, Stamkos and Hedman, Taves and Kane, McKinnon and Makar and Landeskog and Rantanen. You need multiple of those top picks. Yeah. Now you need them to reach their potential, and that's no guarantee. Mm-hmm. But you have more opportunities the worse you are to pick up there to find those players.
For every group of players like that, the ideal ones that you just mentioned, there's other teams that didn't get that. Like the Devils, they got Nico Hischier, who's a good player. He's not Makar, McKinnon, the caliber that we're talking about. And so that's made it harder for the Devils to get great. They haven't been great. They still are technically in the rebuild category in this criteria.
Yes, they are.
Here's one thing that I found very noteworthy with your question, right? To the audience, is are you okay with this if you do a rebuild? Because that's the question I always ask. Are you willing to go through? I don't even talk about 8 years. I talk about 4 years or 5 years. Are you willing to have 4 or 5 years of struggles, big struggles? In the article, it does talk about how the fan base usually is pretty patient, right? If you declare you're in this rebuild, you get time. And the fans are like, okay, I see what you're doing. But do we think that's actually true?
It says here at the end of the article, why are so many front offices moving glacially slow to rebuild their rosters right now? And one of them is fan bases are more accepting of rebuilds. If you scroll through social media for 30 seconds, you might dispute this point. But despite how impulsive fandom has become, rebuilds are considered the best way to win consistently. Not long ago, it would be embarrassing to miss the playoffs 3, 5, or 7 times straight. Now, it's just part of the plan.
Okay, so I think this would be a great question to ask Blackhawk fans, right? Mm-hmm. The Blackhawks, since the Predators swept them in 2017, on the way to the great run they had, the Blackhawks have been 25th, 20th, 23rd, 20th, 27th, 30th, 31st, 31st. Are they still sitting there going, yeah, we're okay. Yeah, we're all right. Let's just keep drafting high. We're going to get there. I wonder how that works, honestly, because these are key questions, because I think there is still a faction of the Predators fan base that still believes that this is what you're supposed to do, right? It's as the article points out, it's sort of accepted practice by some of the GMs, because the Blackhawks are not alone here, right? There's at least double digit teams.
Nearly half the league is under a rebuild right now.
And conservatively, even if you don't go strictly by their definition, mm-hmm. it's at least a third of the league.
Yeah.
That have been in this and been in this cycle for 4 or more years already and counting.
One texter, Joel, says, if we could guarantee Gavin McKenna, then tank, but Trotz and definitely Bruno have no interest in having another season as the last. Joey from Gallatin says, I just can't see Trotzy being okay with finishing bottom 10 again this year. After hearing some of the players reflect on the season, I can't imagine the veterans brought in along with the core of the team would be okay coming up so short back-to-back seasons. Joey from Bellevue says, the Preds will finish in the bottom 10 again. You're saying they've never been a part of a rebuild. It's inevitable for them to rebuild, especially with the core being an older group.
They may come to that conclusion about halfway through this season, and that could send them that way. That to me is what has been smart about Barry Trotz's proceedings, right? What he did last year backfired. It didn't work. But in doing all of those things that he did, the bold signings last year, what he's done to try to shape the roster this year and say what he talks about is a possible bounce back, he hasn't affected his farm system and his ability to stockpile a lot of picks. Now, what they do with those picks and how they develop those picks, they really do need somebody to surprisingly exceed the expectations that the Scott Wheelers and the Corey Pronmans and the other people that evaluate farm systems, they need somebody to jump in there for this to work and for them to be different than a lot of these teams that have to hit rock bottom year after year to really rebuild.
615-737-1025. So the data from Daily Faceoff shows that rebuilds do work, but the average length, 8.5 years. Would you be willing to wait that long if you were more likely than not to challenge for a championship once that's over? 615-737-1025. We'll wrap up the show next. Willie Donick, Adam Vingan, 1025-1063 The Game. D-Mace Vingan and Donick, 1025-1063 The Game. Willie Donick, Adam Vingan. Chase McKay will join us in just a second. But first, let's go to Shay on our phone line, driven by WilsonCountyHyundai.com. Shay, thank you for calling. Please go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call. I really enjoy your show.
Thank you.
I listen to it every day while I sit in a car and my son practices. But as far as the rebuild goes, I'm a third-year season ticket holder, so I'm kind of new to this. And I understand these rebuilds can take a while. Based on your statistics, I didn't know it would take 8 years. But let's just say it does. I can tell you right now, my 12-year-old will not be in for that. However, to get my badge of honor to say I was there when the team's bad, it would take a lot from the Predators to convince us to stick around, like, you know, locking in lower ticket prices, upgrading seats. And I don't know if they're willing to do that, because Nashville's a different animal when you're dealing with Bridgestone. I don't know what other organizations have done. I would be willing to stick around because I know it's a process, as long as that process worked. But, you know, those are the type of things they would have to do to get a fan like us to stick around, especially driving 50 miles to come, you know, watch a numerous amount of games. So I don't know what your thoughts on that, but they would have to really sweeten the pot. And I can tell you this year they didn't do it. They just basically said there's no pricing freeze. I was like, okay, well, thank you very much, considering how we did this past year. But so that's kind of where I am with it. I know my 12-year-old would not like that at all, but I'd be willing to stick around if they locked in ticket prices, upgraded seats, did things for the fans to try to at least make it entertaining. But Nashville and Bridgestone, they're kind of full of it sometimes. So I don't know if they're willing to do that to a rebuild. What are your thoughts?
Thank you for the call, Shay.
I think he's raising a really interesting question. Is if you intentionally enter into the rebuild, and let's just use the Sharks as an example. And the Sharks are struggling with their attendance right now. I can tell you that the games that the Predators played in San Jose were both very exciting games, but there was no crowd to speak of at either game. So their attendance has suffered. I don't know what each organization, once they sort of make this choice, does with their season ticket holders and prices. What do they do? I'm sure they have to get creative at some point, because you can preach it, right? The GMs can say, hey, we are where we are. This is going to be tough. We're building the farm system. Here are our young players. That's marketable to some degree, but after a while, that's why I asked the question in Chicago, a huge market, right, that's had a lot of success. And they're still feeding off of that success, right? They're apt to be more patient because they won the three cups, right? San Jose might be a little different, a little more of a non-traditional market. A lot of successful teams, but never did win the cup, right? What do you do for that fan base? Because they're really struggling. Chicago, I think, has done a pretty good job of still getting people to come to their games, even though they've been awful the last few years. I guess people will come to see Bedard play for a while, even though he's young and they lose. They've been feeding off of that. These are all really good questions that are not part of this article, right? This only goes to your success on the ice. It's not the business side of it.
Let's bring in our fearless leader, Chase McCabe, live in Atlanta for SEC Media Days. Hello, Chase. How are you?
What's up, boys? How we doing?
We are doing quite well. I loved your interviews yesterday, all show long. I wanted to ask you about Diego Pavia. You had the opportunity to sit down with Pavia. You got to see him interact with others at SEC Media Days. You used the term rock star to describe the vibe of Diego Pavia. So what was it like to sit down with him and to see him interact with the world of the SEC yesterday in Atlanta?
I will tell you, we have a ton of interviews that we've recorded today. And every single person, as they came to our table, said, man, how about that Pavia? It's got to be fun covering him. He plays the part. And I think that's what Clark Lee wants him to play. Clark, told us, I want him to be him. And he is him. He is true to himself. He does not like to lose. He showed up, basically wearing a tuxedo and had his diamonds in his earrings. And just, look, and Willie, you know this. You've been around Vandy a long time. They've never had a guy like that. They've had good players, but they've never had someone that's going to command the room and steal the show like he did walking on Radio Row and doing all the interviews and everything that he did yesterday. And so I think that is huge for Vanderbilt. Obviously, they got to replicate and do even more than what they did last year. And I think they can. The problem is they play in a league that is just so tough. We just talked to Greg McElroy, who you will hear at 1 o'clock on our show today. And, one of the things he said was there's like three or four teams at the top, and then it's everybody else, and then maybe Mississippi State. But the key in that is Vandy's not that last team anymore. Vandy is very much in the mix, and Pavia has a lot to do with that.
Let me ask you this question, Willie. Going off of Chase's point, because you are a Vanderbilt historian, a proud Commodore, how many Vanderbilt athletes can you recall that have had the stage presence of Diego Pavia?
In football, I would say probably none.
None.
I don't think there's been another guy like that. Jay Cutler was fairly charismatic, and he was...
Not like that, though.
He was a pro prospect, but nothing like Pavia. Pavia, I think it remains to be seen if he can develop to a point where he becomes a pro prospect. He certainly has a belief that he's going to play in the NFL, that he's going to find a way to get in there. That's what makes him good. The thing about Vanderbilt, I think, to balance Pavia's bravado, you have Clark Lee, that has made the point clear that the objective of the team is to make sure you're not complacent for 1 second. Because last year, and you're playing one of the toughest schedules in the country, ESPN has them the second toughest schedule in the nation. He said they went 4-4 in one score games last year, and they ended up 7-6. So he said, we're just as close to 2-10 if you don't win any of those games as you are 10-2 if you were to win all those games. I think that's one of the great things that they were able to do last year, is unlike the year before where they were blown out of basically every SEC game, that they were basically in every SEC game last year. So I think that's what I would think is in front of them. A lot of close game, a lot of games against teams that they're going to be underdogs against. And can Pavia come through in those games like he did last year? It's not a given, right? It's not a given. No. Regardless of how much bravado he has and how much better on paper their roster looks, they're returning a lot more production this year. They've been able to keep players that they weren't able to keep before. A lot of it is because of Pavia. And I think they've been able to attract players that weren't attracted to the program before. They had a bunch of nobodies. It was the dregs, right? Like, hey, I don't have anywhere else to go. Okay, I'll come to Vanderbilt. That's what they were dealing. That's what Pavia was, right? He wasn't getting his phone ringing from Kentucky and Auburn and Ohio State and Michigan. He came to Vanderbilt because it was a unique situation. They were bringing the coaching staff, and the coaching staff
that
from
was
Mexico
key, though,
State
Willie.
Was saying, hey, well, you need to bring Diego Pavia. Just bring him over.
Yeah, I mean, Tim Beck and Jerry Kill coming on, and Coach Lee acknowledged that. I mean, that was key to the whole situation of getting Pavia on. So,
Chase, I want to ask you, yesterday, Diego Pavia had quite the audience for his news conference. I can only imagine what it's going to be like today when Arch Manning addresses reporters. We talked about this early in the show. I think the Arch Manning hype train has left the station. It's off the rails with other train metaphors you want to use. Is there a buzz in the room about Arch Manning talking today?
There is a buzz in the room, and it's interesting. Joe has brought it up with a lot of people that we've talked to, including Chuck Oliver, who does a syndicated show on college football and does radio here in Atlanta. And it's like, look, I get it, but he hadn't done a whole lot yet. And we say that about other quarterbacks that are coming in this year. The difference is their last name isn't Manning. And, you know, I said if this was Arch Vingen or Arch Donick, we're not having this conversation.
Archbishop.
Well done. You know, it's completely different. But because he's a third generation, he's Peyton and Eli's nephew, Cooper's son, Archie's grandson, he's going to get that hype. And now it's, can he, you know, truly live up to it on the big stage? Adam, you'll appreciate this. There's a who's who of media from Texas here, including the world's strongest man, Mark Henry.
Of course.
Who does radio, I guess, in the Austin area now. He's here on Radio Row. We're going to try and get him on here in a little bit. But, you know, he's here to cover Arch and Steve Sarkisian. I mean, there's so much hype with Texas. And you ask people around here, they'll tell you, Texas, Georgia, Alabama, and then maybe LSU are kind of the upper echelon, and then it's everybody else. So we'll see what Arch has to say later on.
And I want to say that Mark Henry's son plays in the SEC.
Oklahoma.
Okay.
And then he's signed a development deal with WWE as well.
Okay.
Chase, what do you think you've learned so far, and what do you think we will learn? Because he's a little bit of a mystery man. But Joey Aguilar, I'm curious. Yeah. What the coaching staff and the people there present him as. Do you think he is the starter, or they're going to couch and say, we don't know? How do you think they'll approach that, all the questions we're going to have, because he's a little bit of a mystery?
The sense that I have gotten is, yes, he is the starter. Coach Heupel is scheduled to join Joe and I a little bit later on. That'll probably happen during Jared's show, and we'll take that live and talk to Coach Heupel and kind of get more of a sense of that and see what he'll say, at least. But everybody else kind of feels like that it is Joey Aguilar's team, but that he could fit Josh Heupel's offense the way that Josh Heupel wants him to. That's why they brought him in. The problem is he does have a tendency to turn the ball over, and that's something that if you look at quarterbacks that have played in this offense, whether it's Hendon Hooker or Joe Milton or Nico, they protected the football. And so that's something that he's going to have to do to keep that up-tempo going in Josh Heupel's offense. But we'll certainly see. We have a packed show. Greg McElroy is going to join us. Commissioner Greg Sankey tomorrow at 12:45. So a lot of stuff coming from Atlanta.
We can't wait to hear it. A reminder that our SEC Media Days coverage is sponsored by Brewhouse South. Experience Nashville's ultimate sports and brew hangout at Brewhouse South in Cool Springs. Chase and Big Joe live from Atlanta. They will take it from here. Willie and I will be back tomorrow at 9 o'clock. On behalf of Derek, be loved, love on your people. Have a wonderful Tuesday. Peace.